Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin, where he's the director of the Inequality Project. James Galbraith serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security, and he writes a column for Mother Jones and occasional commentary in many other publications, including the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and the Nation. We'll be talking about the extra $200 billion for the Iraq War that President Bush is asking for in 2008, and look at its impact on the United States economy and on our position in the global economy. And also we'd discuss the recent book of the former Fed chair, Alan Greenspan. Then we'll talk with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, at the Air War College, and at the Naval War College. During his military career, he worked on identifying nuclear targets, and we'll be talking to him about some of the warnings that he's been issuing and of a number of indicators that suggest the United States is preparing for an attack on Iran. And, of course, this will be discussed in the recent context of the recent mysterious Israeli bombing of a reputed North Korean nuclear site in Syria. And then we'll talk with Dr. Paul Rogers, who's a professor of peace studies at the University of Bradford in England. He focuses on trends in international conflict, developing an analysis of the linkages between socioeconomic divisions, environmental constraints, and international security. In his recent web column on Open Democracy, which is a web journal, he has written an article suggesting that events between the United States and Iran will stimulate and spark a war, either intentional or unintentionally. I'm now speaking with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin, and where he's also the director of the Inequality Project. And as I mentioned, he writes a column for Mother Jones and occasionally commentary for the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and the Nation. And just it looks as though in Sunday's headlines that President Bush will be asking for $200 billion extra for 2008. That, of course, increases the bill considerably. You've just returned from abroad. Is our position in the global economy being, particularly where you notice the dollar is now on parity with the Canadian dollar, basically, do the rest of the world have a kind of schadenfreude? Are they enjoying our pain? Are our competitors enjoying our pain?
I don't think they're enjoying it in Europe, no. We just saw in Britain last week the first run on a bank, real run on the bank with people lining up outside trying to get their deposits.
Echoes of the Great Depression,
I guess. The 1860s. Right. And it was a really remarkable scene, and this was a bit of blowback from the junk mortgage, subprime mortgage crisis that originated in the United States. The fact that the euro is now up at $1.40, an all-time high, is making anybody who tries to export out of Europe extremely nervous. So this has got major repercussions around the world, and people are enjoying, as you say, schadenfreude. It's tempered by a consciousness that everybody's connected to the health of the U.S. economy.
And does that mean that, for example, the Russians and the Chinese feel that way? I mean, is there a kind of mutually exclusive quotient here in the world economy where as others lose, others gain?
Well, no, I don't think that our problems will derail the Chinese economy, but they could hit Chinese export earnings, and they could hit the inflow of speculative capital into China, which has been fueling the real estate bubble, the stock market bubble there. And so there will be consequences for the Chinese economy for sure.
Well, there's a new study out by Linda Milmus and the Nobel laureate economist Joe Stiglitz suggesting that we spend on the Iraq War it's costing us $720 million each day, And with that money, you could buy homes for almost 6,500 families or healthcare for 423,529 children. Of course, we know that the president is threatening to veto and efforts to extend health coverage to the children of the poor in this country, or could outfit 1.27 million homes with renewable electricity. These are a number of the comparisons that are made in this study by Stiglitz and the Harvard Public Finance lecturer, Linda Bilmes. Do you think that that this debate is going to sort of get through to the mainstream consciousness of the American people? I think they're switched off from the Iraq war rather than outraged at what it's costing them.
Well, Linda and Joe have been doing a series of papers released through an organization that I happen to be the chair of called Economists for Peace and Security. This is part of that, and extremely valuable papers. And what they show is that the money that we're directly spending on the Iraq war is basically just a down payment, a very small down payment, for what we're going to be committed to spend, forced to spend, to take care of the later costs, in particular the treatment of returning veterans, which has been scandalously under-budgeted, under-prepared for, under-financed, and the later on the military pension costs and other issues, as well as re-equipping the armed forces whose equipment is being worn out in those very harsh conditions at a very, very rapid rate. So we're looking at the overall bill is going to be between $1 and $2 trillion. This is by no means a small operation or take it into the long run context, a small drain on U.S. resources. It's very substantial.
And Dr. James Galbraith, is that figure of between $1 and $2 trillion, that is what we've spent so far? That doesn't project further
That's the full cost. That's projecting further.
Further, I see.
That's projecting further. I mean, the numbers that we've already spent are building up very rapidly. But what you're looking at in this war is of a large number of very badly injured young men and women coming back who will require very expensive long-term care and who would not have survived if they'd sustained similar injuries in previous wars. And this phenomenon, a very large number of injured relative to the number who've been killed, is something for which this administration was totally unprepared. And the scandal, which Linda Bilmes has documented very carefully, of the ill preparation of the veterans' services for this and of the military generally for the returning veterans is an extremely important story.
So again, Dr. James Galbraith, how does this relate to the domestic political debate? I mean, in other words, where's the outrage? I imagine that within the Republican ranks, from the traditional business-friendly Wall Street branch, Main Street Wall Street branch, rather than the religious conservatives and the social conservatives, there's a certain outrage because that flies in the face of what people in corporate America are supposed to be doing. In other words, if you manage your corporation the way that the Bush team have managed this war, you'd be out on your ear, wouldn't you?
Well, business interests are split. There are a group of corporations, the Beltway Bandits and the defense contractors, who have profited enormously and who form the core clientele and constituency of this administration. But there is a larger body of American business interest which is actually being harmed by this. It's being harmed. There's certainly a large body of the American household interest, family interest, which are being harmed by the fall in the dollar. And this is all part and parcel of the effects of this war, not only the cost of the war, but its effect on America's standing in the world. The problem is that the beneficiaries are, as always, very concentrated, very well organized, and they have the administration at their beck and call. Those who are harmed are relatively diffuse. They don't understand the linkages all that well, and they don't have an effective political voice. Also, nobody's articulated a clear alternative foreign policy except in very general terms. But it's extremely clear to me that the security of the United States has got to be conceived of in much broader terms than this administration has been willing or capable or inclined to do.
And you don't think the collapsing bridge in Minnesota was a clue here to the American public?
I think the American public is ahead of this. The American public can see the steam pipes exploding in Manhattan, can see the bridges collapsing. It can read what's going on with respect to global warming, and they can see very clearly that nothing effective is being done, that what we're getting is eyewash on that issue. They can see that their interests are not being served. What we don't have in the American political system is a clearly or well-organized, clearly articulated alternative policy capable of taking the realms of government and the reins of government and changing the direction that the system has been heading. That's something we very much need.
And Dr. James Galbraith, the book by Alan Greenspan has gotten a lot of attention, Fidel Castro held it up in a long interview he did on Cuban television as recommended reading. He's making the rounds of starting with 60 Minutes. What's your sense then of his apparent internal or his concern that he was misunderstood and that he didn't really endorse these tax cuts? So many people are criticizing him for saying, well, if you felt that when you're inside the government, why did you speak out?
Well, the chairman of the Federal Reserve is responsible mainly for monetary policy. He can be asked to comment on other matters, but he's not responsible for directing tax policy. Greenspan got a lot of criticism because people said he didn't speak out and give his true view of the Bush tax cuts. The fact is, and I think he says this in his book, but in January of 2001, he did give testimony in which he stated what his views were. This has recently been called to my attention. I wasn't aware of it. But my view is, since he did do that, the responsibility lay with those who opposed the tax cuts at the time and who weren't in position to call attention to Greenspan's views, to take what he said and make sure the public was aware of it, and they failed in that responsibility. So my view is this is really the fault of our team, not the fault of Alan Greenspan. If I had been back in my old job on the congressional staff and this witness had come before me and had laid those very pregnant paragraphs on the table in January 2001, I would have flogged them unmercifully, unscrupulously. I would have taken great delight in making sure they were, every time a member I was working with opened their mouths, I would have had them quoting those paragraphs. But that didn't happen, and that's the responsibility of the consumers in the Congress, not necessarily, I think, Greenspan's responsibility.
And Dr. Galbraith, what did you make of Greenspan's comments, which the White House were upset about, that the Iraq War was about oil?
Well, I think it's a rather casually stated view. Oil was certainly part of the picture, but the question of whether we were trying to control the oil in the ground or simply to control the world oil markets, it has to be analyzed, I think, more carefully than at least I haven't read the passage in Greenspan's book, so I don't know if he says anything more than that, but it seems to me one has to look at that question very carefully and analyze it a little bit before the meaning of a comment like that becomes clear.
Well, there's a lot of about the conventional sort of knee-jerk reaction that it's all about oil and this was an oil grab and the Cheney's an oil man and all this stuff. One of the things that's always puzzled me about the Iraq situation is it has always served the interests, particularly of Saudi Arabia, to have Iraqi oil off the market. And Iraqi oil has been off the market since 1990.
Yes,
and it continues
exactly
to stay
right.
off the market.
And one has to believe, if the objective here had been to bring Iraqi oil to the United States, making that happen would have been a greater priority in the period since 2003 than has been the case. In fact, there are no American oil companies, so far as I know, effectively working to bring the large southern Iraqi oil fields into production. And that being so, I mean, if the oil strategy, if you want to interpret it, I would say a more plausible story is that the grand strategists here wanted a high price because that would make operations in places which are much more costly technically to bring oil out of the ground more profitable, whereas bringing the Iraqi oil onto the market might well have depressed the price and put a great many of those fields on the margin of profitability or even out of business. And that seems to me at least a more coherent economic explanation of what's actually occurred. But there's the other possibility that they wanted to achieve something and they simply didn't know how to go about it and weren't totally incompetent. And that those two hypotheses compete with each other for the moment.
Well, recently, Dr. Galbraith, I've spoken with Morgan Stanley economist Stephen Roach and then Nouriel Roubini as well. And Roubini thinks that we're actually heading into a recession, and by the first quarter of next year, it'll be quite evident and it'll be quite nasty. And of course, it relates to the subprime meltdown. On top of everything else, I can't imagine if the president and the Republicans are responsible for a recession that they have a prayer in 08. But first of all, do you think that that's in the cards?
I think what has happened in the financial markets in the month of August is extremely serious. It was serious enough to blow away the long-established policy line of the Federal Reserve in a matter of 10 days. On August 7th, they issued a statement saying that the failure or the possibility that inflation might not moderate was still their predominant policy concern. By 10 days after that, they'd opened the discount window, cut the rate to a half a point over the Fed funds rate, told the banks to borrow as much as they wanted. And then on September 18th, as we've seen, they've cut the federal funds rate by half a point. So they clearly, what you're seeing here is the reaction to a seismic event. I firmly believe that that reaction will not be enough because, I mean, and Alan Greenspan has also talked about this with considerable clarity and candor. We are looking at an unfolding series of events which reflect a loss of confidence by the banks in each other's fundamental underlying condition, as well as in the condition of non-bank institutions, which are, don't have direct access to the Federal Reserve's lending. And so getting control of that situation is a task which is technically very difficult, and it may not be achievable. In addition to that, we have already seeing a free fall in the housing sector. We're seeing a squeeze on the capacity of American households, particularly lower-income households, to borrow in order to sustain their consumption. So these forces are going to cut into economic growth from one direction and from the other. Whether it will produce a recession or not, still a little too early to tell, but it's extremely plausible and possible that it will. And when it does, if it does, we're going to see, first of all, a major increase in the federal budget deficit, and it will be very interesting to see whether either monetary or fiscal policy is available to get us out of it. And certainly in the last year of an administration, particularly one that's as badly discredited as this one, you won't be able to expect any major initiatives. So 2008 could be really quite grim from an economic standpoint.
And in terms of the Blanche Dubois economy that others have coined, the extent to which the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and others buy our debt, how do we continue to make our debt? And that ties into this idea that we have to go to the mall all the time. So how do we make our debt more attractive with the dollar dropping?
Well, it's obvious that the Federal Reserve gave up on any hope of maintaining the dollar when it cut the federal funds rate, and the dollar immediately fell. And that's an adjustment which entirely predictable. I'm sure they understood it would happen. They were forced, in other words, to choose between averting a financial crisis and protecting the dollar. They had to give up the dollar. I don't dispute that choice under the circumstances, but that's the reality. Now, what the reaction will be on the part of the Chinese and others who have been accumulating dollar assets, they're obviously taking a loss on those assets right now. They will certainly be tempted to diversify. I'm very cautious about predicting the end of the current monetary system because there isn't a well-formed alternative out there. But it does seem to me that we have to look forward to the day when the dollar will not be the only choice of reserve asset in the world economy. People will be increasingly using euro and perhaps other currencies, but euro will be the main one, in which case we are going to face, there will be stronger inflationary pressures, higher commodity prices in dollar terms, higher oil prices as a result of that. And that's going to be a problem, which will again pose very difficult choices for economic policymakers down the road. It seems to me that the correct approach to this is to focus on, first of all, reestablishing our security presence. I talked about that earlier, in ways which do not require the reliance on these extraordinarily expensive wars, which in fact are unsuccessful, rebuilding our domestic economy, reestablishing our technical preeminence in areas where the world will need our help, need our leadership. If we can do that in the next 8-year administration, then we may come out of this with living standards more or less unimpaired and reasonably good leadership position in the world economy. If we continue down the current path, the idea that the present system will stumble along for another 8 years seems to me to be a little bit far-fetched at this point.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. James Galbraith.
Okay, pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics and a variety of other subjects at the LBJ School of the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project there, and he serves as the senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and is the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. They did the study on how we're spending $720 million a day in Iraq and what it would buy in terms of fixing things here at home. And he also writes a column for Mother Jones and occasional commentary for the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and the Nation magazine. I'm now speaking with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, Air War College, and the Naval War College. During his military career, he worked on identifying nuclear targets, and he has been warning for some time there are a number of indicators that suggest the United States is preparing for an attack on Iran. How does this tie in, then, Colonel Sam Gardner, to these recent mysterious Israeli bombing of the reputed North Korean nuclear site in Syria?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that nobody heard about it. There was never any a warning that it was coming. There was never any indication that North Korea had connections with Iran. The only thing we heard was an attack has taken place, and governments, both Israel and the United States, were only reluctantly have been talking about it, and had it not been some leaks to press sources, we probably wouldn't know very much about it. But essentially, it was the kind of attack that we might see conducted against Iran facilities.
Well, first of all, it's another example of intelligence being stovepiped directly from Israel into the White House and in effect into Dick Cheney's office. So the rest of the intelligence community has been pretty much kept out of this, from what I understand.
Well, I'm not sure about that. There was an article in Friday's Washington Post which suggested that sort of the nod or the agreement didn't come until U.S. intelligence separately confirmed what Israeli intelligence had been saying.
Which is what? We don't know.
Yeah, no, we don't know. In fact, we don't know what the target is yet. There is an article in the Times of London this morning which seems to be the best, and when I say the best, I mean it seems to make the most sense. One of the things that they were talking about in that article is that the North Koreans might have been helping the Syrians with technology that allowed them to have an airburst warhead. Now, that sounds kind of technical, but what that means is on a missile to have the capability so that it will detonate prior to hitting the ground. Now, that technology is important both for nuclear weapons, but maybe even more important for chemical weapons. And we know Syria has chemical weapons. So this could very well have been a step forward in the Syrian chemical weapon program. Chemical weapons are only effective if you can disperse them, and you can't disperse them if they just go to a hole in the ground.
Well, I understand that that technology, there was for the longest time, the Soviets didn't even have it. And I imagine what has happened here is that the North Koreans have somehow gotten hold of this. Because it involves radar, because it's coming in at 17,000 miles per hour. It's reasonably sophisticated technology, but I imagine it came originally from the Soviets to the North Koreans, and they're pretty much selling anything they can, aren't they?
Well, they seem to be on the market, but I would just add a footnote that we read about, I guess it's been about 2 years ago now, that Iran had actually been working on it. There were reports that they had been able to achieve that technology. So, you know, there could be, the North Koreans could be selling to both Iran and Syria, and we just now have seen it surfaced about what's happening in Syria.
So how does this, Sam, going to tie into Iran? I mean, some people say that just the idea of going through Syrian airspace with apparent contempt for the Syrians indicates that would be the corridor for an attack to Iran. And the other point, I guess, is that there hasn't been too much international outrage, and I think Iran probably is finding itself pretty much alone.
Yes, and I would add one other dimension to that, which is Turkey.
They did. It was close to the Turkish border, wasn't it?
Yes, and they actually found Israeli drop tanks from their aircraft, for fuel tanks, that had been dropped off inside Turkish territory. And there has not been particular outrage from Turkey. So what that sort of suggests is that the close relationship between Turkey and Israel may be, there may be some underground agreements that suggest that route is possible. The one thing I have to add, however, is, and in fact, there's a Newsweek article that describes the U.S.-Israeli connection. The United States has to be very careful about turning over its foreign policy to Israel. The United States has to be very careful that it not allow Israel to start a greater Middle East war without its consent anyway.
Well, that may be what's happening here, though, that Israel's acting as a surrogate for the United States. I mean, there's two possibilities. Either they act as a surrogate for the United States, or two, we get blamed for what they do.
Yes, the latter is what my worry is. If we just hypothesize that somehow Israel had worked out this corridor through Turkish airspace and would violate Syrian airspace to attack Iran, and if they did, this is not the first time that they would have acted alone. There's every indication that the Iranians would not see that just as an Israeli attack. They would believe that the United States was part of it. They would use that domestically to generate support, and they would have to retaliate. I mean, they would be put in a position for support at home that they had no alternative but to retaliate.
Surely, Colonel Gardner, that the U.S., given the situation in Iraq, where it's pretty much pinned down, where the Iranians have the upper hand, and they could escalate enormously with great speed and with great pain to the United States, I can't imagine that the U.S. military would be happy about Israel putting them in a situation like that. I mean, there's got to be some.
I agree, but I guess what I would say is one's imagination shouldn't be limited about policy errors. We've seen them repeated over and over again. And again, I will quote the Newsweek article, who suggests there has been talk in the vice president's office that a limited strike into Iran could be a wonderful opportunity to open up a general strike against Iranian leadership. One has to keep one's imagination open about how policy errors can be made.
Well, I think you can also look at what's happening in Iraq, and particularly with the testimony last week of General Petraeus, that the subtext of what really is not being discussed here in terms of the surge is that that you know our military occupation of Iraq has clearly failed, but Iran's political occupation has succeeded. They essentially, this government that's kind of a fiction, but it seems to be more loyal and in line with Iran than it is with us. And this is what's alarming the Sunni kings, the Saudis, and Abdullah in Jordan. And I just had a friend from the State Department who went to a conference in London last week, and he said the delegation from Bahrain, that island between Iran and Saudi Arabia, are just terrified that they're going to go under if there's a war, and they think there might be a war. So
a war with Iran.
Essentially between Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
In other words, the point I'm making here is that already the Saudis and the Iranians are engaged in a proxy war in Iraq, and the so-called surge, I think, is a tactical shift that recognizes the belated reality that our former Sunni enemy is now our new friend against Iran, who President Bush foolishly empowered. So, you know, the Sunnis, having been ethnically cleansed and driven into Anbar province, they want a temporary truce with us so that they can take on the so-called Persians, which is the name they use for the Iraqi Shia. So isn't that really what's happening? In other words, we're in a sense, we're suddenly switching sides and realizing, hey, wait a minute, we're propping up the pro-Iranian guys and we should be fighting with the anti-Iranian guys. And to that extent, we're already on the path to war against Iran.
Let me pick up on that with two points. The first point is, you know, it's very interesting to me that the administration has made a big deal of the Iranian involvement in Iraq in about the last, say, 9 months. There, however, was an argument inside the administration that goes back to about the fall of 2003, when the Iranian influence was beginning to be clear. There was a division. The Defense Department wanted the world to know about it. The State Department didn't want the world to know about it. And I think State's position came from the argument that if you make the world know this is happening, then you're going to be forced to do something. So that we now that we keep practically every day, one of the generals in Iraq points to Iran as being the source. So that's sort of the first point I want to make on your argument. Now, I want to pick up on that in the vice president's argument that goes way back to the start of using force after 9/11. His argument is the only reason people do these things is because they don't believe the United States would be strong. And there's every reason to believe he would say to what you and I were just arguing that the reason Iran is doing this is because they're not convinced we would be firm with them. So the argument that sort of comes because of what Iran is doing is that we have got to strike them. Now, again, I'm not making my own argument. I'm making the vice president's argument to show them that we can be firm or their influence will continue to grow in the Middle East. And it is only because of their vision of our weakness that they are now interfering in Afghanistan as well as in Iran. So that logic then leads you to, well, that's why we have to strike Iran.
So how would you categorize the state of war between the United States and Iran at this point? Is it we've already established, I think it's pretty clear that the Iraq war has essentially become a proxy war between the Sunni, supported by Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and to a lesser extent Egypt, and the Shia, supported by Iran and to a lesser extent Syria. We know that President Bush has authorized substantial covert activity to destabilize the mullahs in Tehran, through Baluchistan and through Kurdish North. So give us your analysis of where we stand in terms of the jargon of warfare.
Okay, I think that I think the administration has decided that they need to have an attempt at a third sanctions package before moving to the next step of striking Iran. And I think that may not be because they believe the sanctions will work, but because they believe an attempt at sanctions are necessary to convince the world that a strike is justified.
And, that, and that's what went on last week at the, in the Security Council, didn't it?
Exactly. And there are reports that this next week it's going to be a full-court press, and we'll see a lot of public mention of the sanctions package. And then if that doesn't work, we can blame the UN. If we do get a sanctions package, it can go on for a while, and then the strike can be justified. I think my I watch very carefully what Benjamin Netanyahu says, because he's seems very close to the White House. He's even calling for sanctions package. And when he does that, you sort of, well, there must be something going on here. And I think what we're going to see is that as the lead card, but we need to watch the second card, because it's going to be dealt either above the table or below the table.
Well, he's been getting a lot of criticism within Israel for having gone public on and saying as much as has been said about this mysterious airstrike in Syria on the 12th of September. So he's pointed out that he's in the loop. So and he's, I think, probably more likely to be. I think he's a front runner, is he not, for the next prime minister?
Well,
in terms of polling, given the weakness of the current government.
That's the sort of the pivotal question. If the storyline emerges that Iran is developing nuclear weapons and they can't be stopped, and that the current leadership in Israel isn't stopping them, then his chances of being elected go up.
Well, because Ahmadinejad has basically told the Israeli people that he wants to extinguish them. I'm not quoting him exactly. So I think there's a lot of support in Israel to do something about Ahmadinejad.
Yes, although he has toned down over the last couple months. And it'd be interesting to know what the reason is, but he has seemed to... he isn't repeating what he had said earlier.
Right, but he met with these disgraceful Holocaust deniers and David Duke and these other crackpots. So,
right.
I mean, nobody, I don't think anybody takes him seriously as a born-again peacenik. I mean, please.
Right.
No, but obviously, he's at the United Nations today. In fact, he's showing up in New York and going to be talking at Columbia, I believe, tomorrow, and at the UN. So we'll see what he has to say. But obviously, there is some rumors of war here, and which is one of the reasons I'm talking to you. So we're trying to sort out rumor from reality.
And up until this last week, I would have said we will know when it's coming, because I had the feeling the administration would follow the same sort of strategic communications plan it had in the first Gulf War, or the second Gulf War, where we saw this unfolding of the storyline. But that raid on Syria sort of left me doubting my previous assumption. We may not see it coming.
Meaning what?
Meaning it could be we could wake up one morning and it has happened without the storyline being developed publicly to generate the support, public support.
So, and what it would be an Israeli airborne attack? Would it be with iron bombs or with cruise missiles against the Natanz facilities? I don't even think the Israelis have the capability of taking that out, do they? Unless
they probably don't. It requires and when I say that, I'm not sure that we haven't told the Israelis we would take care of it for all the reasons we had said before.
Well, it makes more sense for the United States to do it, because if Israel does it, the United States is going to get blamed and they will be retaliated against.
That's exactly
so
right.
You might as well go ahead and do it yourselves, since you've got much, much greater capability than the Israelis have and you're right there in the neighborhood.
And I would sort of add, that I think the logic would say you don't just go after the nuclear facilities. That if you're going to do it, I would bet that the military guys are arguing this, if you're going to do it, you also need to go after the Iranian capabilities to retaliate. That means you go after the missile sites. That means you go after the three submarines that the Iranians have that could interfere with Gulf shipping. That means you go after the Iranian Air Force. That means you go after the anti-ship cruise missiles that are along the opening of the Gulf, so that you take the sting away from the bee if you're going to stir him up. But that's still not going to stop the retaliation. I mean, there's every reason to believe that there may even be sleeper cells in the United States that the Iranians could turn on.
Well, there's a substantial amount of evidence, or I don't know about evidence when you deal with intelligence matters, but supposedly in Canada there's, and in Brazil as well, and in Mexico. But the biggest Iranian surrogate, of course, in terms of retaliation, would be Hezbollah in Lebanon.
See, here's why we should worry about that. What you and I just said, let's say that Hezbollah does something in the United States. We will be able to find the fingerprint. We will be able to trace it back to Iran. That fact then puts the administration in a position of having to do something. You know, the Iranians have struck inside the United States. It's almost like 9/11 again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We then are in a position that we have to probably go for regime change. We then force ourselves into a greater Middle East war with land forces that could go on many years. We have forced ourselves into starting a conflict that puts the price of oil at $150. We have forced ourselves into a conflict that destroys the American economy.
Makes sense. So we'd have to close out now, Colonel Sam Gardner. But the downside seems to be so great here that it's hard to believe that any rational person would consider these options that we're discussing. And I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He's taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, the Air War College, and the Naval War College. And during his military career, he worked on identifying nuclear targets. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Paul Rogers, who's a professor of peace studies at the University of Bradford in England. He focuses on trends in international conflict, developing an analysis of the linkages between socioeconomic divisions, environmental constraints, and international insecurity. In his weekly column for the Open Democracy Web Journal, he has a new article out on what may spark a war with Iran. And what do you think, Dr. Paul Rogers, in terms of the mysterious Israeli bombing of this reputed North Korean nuclear site in Syria, is that in any way a portent of things to come with Iran?
Well, Ian, good morning. Yes, it certainly is. It's possible. I mean, there is very little information available on what that raid was really about. It seems unusual if the Syrians had decided to take the nuclear route. On the other hand, there is quite clearly a North Korean connection. It's also the case that the Israelis used a very long route to undertake this bombing raid. To some extent, it could be seen almost as a kind of training mission for something bigger. But it's one of a number of factors which has increased tensions across the region, particularly involving Israel, but especially the Iran and the United States. And I think the situation at present is that because of the level of tensions raised by people on both sides, a much stronger rhetoric, I think the risk of almost an accidental or a preempted war is greater. I think it is less likely that you're going to see a sudden attack from the United States, perhaps slightly less likely from Israel, but I think it could happen almost by accident. I only caught the last bit of your interview with Colonel Sam Gardner. I would agree very strongly with his comments at the end, where he said that if it did come to any war between the United States and Iran, then this would not be just an American attack on the nuclear facilities. It would go much wider than that. And I also agree that it would set in motion a wider Middle East conflict that certainly would last many years.
Well, that's why one questions whether or not any of this is possible. I mean, there have to be people inside the U.S. government that are putting forth these arguments to restrain if indeed Dick Cheney is the Darth Vader that Hillary Clinton described him as this week. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for the United States to get involved in another war, more protracted, against an infinitely stronger foe when you already have been effectively defeated in Iraq, to take on another greater foe, which would inevitably and immediately become a regional war, threatening the economic lifeline of the industrial economies, and it would only benefit China and Russia.
Well, I would agree with you, but I think one does have to appreciate that at least in the neoconservative worldview, Iran was always the greater threat. I mean, it was said back in 2002 that the road to Tehran went through Baghdad, and I remember speaking to a leading neoconservative in Washington at that time who said quite bluntly, look, if we get Iraq right, we will not have to go for Iran, and that is the real big threat to our interests in the Middle East. The problem is that Iraq, put it bluntly, has not been got right, and therefore from that particular position, Iran remains to be dealt with within the lifetime of the Bush administration. But I would also say, and this is the point I made in the Open Democracy article, that this does not necessarily mean we are facing a sudden war initiated by the United States. I actually think myself that one has to look also at internal Iranian society, and the position at present is that the Revolutionary Guard within Iran, it's been around a long time, it's a kind of army within an army, it doesn't have the same status within Iranian society that it had 10 or 12 years ago, and I think there are many people in the Revolutionary Guard who would actually welcome a military confrontation with the United States to demonstrate that Iran still needed its defenders, the defenders of the revolution. And I think there is a risk of an incident which could suddenly escalate, rather like the capturing of those 15 British sailors and Marines a few months ago, but involving American troops, initiated by what you might almost call rogue Republican Guard, Revolutionary Guard elements, but then leading on to a confrontation. And given the state of tension and the level of armaments that the U.S. Navy has in the Gulf, that's a dangerous predicament, and that's the one I fear at present.
So this the notion that we're in the United Nations now trying to get resolutions for a new sanctions package, and also to isolate and identify the Al-Quds, the armed wing of the Revolutionary Guards, as an international menace. First of all, Sam Gardner was saying that the sanctions package, the new sanctions package, we're going to try that first, and if that fails, then it gives more credence to the notion that there's no choice but to take the military route.
I'm sure they will try the sanctions package first. I'm sure Colonel Gardner is right on that. I'm also sure that any sanctions package which goes through the UN Security Council will not be especially strong and will not have the required effect within Iran. One has to appreciate that President Ahmadinejad is running an administration which is nothing like as popular as when he won the election. He has not delivered on economic growth for the poorest sectors of Iranian society. He is actually less popular. His party lost quite seriously in some recent municipal elections. So you actually have somebody there who, if anything, if there are sanctions, can say, well, this is the West against us. Secondly, and perhaps in some ways more importantly, you are not going to get support from Russia or China for the kind of complete package of sanctions which will really affect the regime in Tehran. The Chinese have multi-billion dollar deals with the Iranians on 25-year gas and oil supply systems. The Russians have all sorts of ways in which they want to stay in with the Iranians, although neither of those countries actually wants any war to break out. But I think we're not going to see the kind of sanctions package which would have a real effect on the Ahmadinejad administration. And consequently, I think the risk does remain that we could see an escalation to something akin to all-out war if we're not careful.
But the odd thing about the neoconservatives, who still seem to have influence, and they even have influence in the campaign of Giuliani, who's running for president on the Republican side. First of all, when the United States had its moment of success, in quotes, in Iraq with the toppling of Saddam's statue before the things went south, the Iranians did approach the United States, did approach the White House, and said, everything's on the table, we want a deal. They were terrified that they'd be next, and they were in a position, or at least we had some leverage over them at that point. Dick Cheney said, we don't talk to evil, and closed the door on that possibility. Now, of course, the tables are turned, and the Iranians have all the cards, and we're in a hell of a position there. And equally true that prior to our intervention in Iraq, the Iranian mullahs were on the defensive against their own people. But nobody in Iran wants to be rescued by the United States if Iraq is the model. So we've lost that leverage. And if we go to war and start bombing these people, they are going to unite behind this unpopular government. So again, there's a sort of history here of this kind of muscular insanity that is so counterintuitive.
Well, I would certainly agree with you on the point you make about Iran. I haven't been to Iran for a couple of years, but when I was last there, which was just before Ahmadinejad was elected, I talked to an old friend who now is a dean at one of the main universities, and he was absolutely adamant that while he himself would certainly not support somebody such as Ahmadinejad, he said that if there was any major threat to the country as a whole, any kind of American or Israeli military action, that would unify the country behind whatever government was in power, no matter how unpopular it was in other respects. I think one cannot underestimate the degree to which within Iran it will be a unifying factor. The idea that a major attack on Iran is going to instigate regime change is absolute nonsense, and very dangerous nonsense as well, because it makes it seem as though you can achieve what you want through military means. In the case of Iran, that is simply not the case. I've no doubt that if the worst scenario did unfold and that we came to some sort of conflict between the United States and Iran, in the first 2 or 3 weeks, the damage done to the Iranian military system, to the nuclear program, even to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards would be considerable, but it would be very much akin to those first 3 weeks which led to the termination of the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. And within a few months, it would be a very different situation. And there, I think, would find the United States mired in an even greater problem than it faces at present in Iraq.
And Dr. Paul Rogers, you're in your current piece on Open Democracy. Is it opendemocracy.org? You're arguing here that the spark could come from either side, from the United States side, the military, particularly in Iraq, where Colonel Gardner pointed out prior to you that every day now generals are coming out talking about Iran. You can see that, I make the argument, in fact, that the current surge is, in fact, a belated recognition on our part and on the part of the Sunni this tactical shift sort of recognizes this belated reality that our Sunni enemy is now our friend against Iran, who we stupidly empowered. So, it seems to me that every day there's more and more talk from our generals in Iraq that Iran is the problem, and also it's true. We're being told that they're also the problem in Afghanistan. All of this may well be true. I mean, I can imagine from the Iranian point of view, they don't want the Americans to succeed, and they're happy to cause them pain. But it seems that within that, as you pointed out, you know, the results would be catastrophic, but the spark is something you can't control. And just in terms of what you just said about internal Iranian politics, isn't it therefore equally likely that these kind of fanatics inside the Revolutionary Guards, who are unpopular with their own people, it could be a possible motivation on their part to create a spark in order to justify their existence?
I think that's very possible, yes. And that, in fact, I think is one of the things which makes the situation potentially rather unstable. But there are other issues as well. You are getting a lot, as you say, coming out from military commanders in Iraq about interference from Iran. I think that's partly because, to some extent, the situation for U.S. forces in Iraq is something of a situation of floundering. It's worth remembering that, in fact, the major Shia group that is opposed to the United States in Iraq is actually the Mehdi army led by Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, he is much more of a nationalist with less links with Iran. In fact, the militia such as the Badr militia, who are actually much closer to Iran, are the ones who are much closer to the current Iraqi government and, if anything, are favored by the United States. You have this extraordinary anomaly within Iraq itself,
right,
that the major Shia militia that, if anything, should be in parallel with the United States, if not against Iran, then cautious, is in fact seen as the enemy. It's really a quite extraordinary circumstance.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us from London. Dr. Paul Rogers is Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Bradford in England, and the regular columnist for opendemocracy.net. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.